Hello and welcome to the first Midori House of 2012, live from Studio One here at Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. In the next hour, we'll be discussing the political outlook for Arab nations in 2012.
If you look back the last 12 months, the biggest story hasn't really been Libya or Tunisia or Yemen or Bahrain, it's been Egypt.
And we'll be staying in the Middle East when Portia Walker joins me in the studio to talk about Libya. We'll be checking in with our New York editor, Aisha Spears, for a talk about what New Year's resolutions mean for the city. And we'll hear from the people who spend their time jumping into freezing cold water at the start of each new year. Yeah, rather them than me. All that plus some great music here on Midori House, live from Studio One with me, Steve Bloomfield. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world with Christian Yeo.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Christian Yeo. Iran's navy has successfully fired another long-range missile. The launch of the weapon, capable of carrying a nuclear warhead, comes towards the end of a 10-day military exercise in the Gulf. Yesterday, America imposed fresh sanctions on financial institutions dealing with Tehran. In response, the Iranian government has threatened to close down a key oil route. Well, motorists and unions in Nigeria have expressed outrage after the price of fuel there more than doubled when government fuel subsidies came to an end. Many fuel stations in Abuja and Lagos have shut whilst they figure out how to adjust their prices. Those which are open are seeing queues of up to an hour. Union leaders have called for more strike action, which had in the past delayed the government from withdrawing the subsidy. Priscilla Abdemviyu is a nurse in Lagos. She says the removal is unfair at a time when most of the country is decaying.
I've been here for 1 hour. I'm supposed to be attending to patients. You can see I'm on scrub. Supposed to be on duty. Suppose it's an emergency. A country where things are not working well. If you want to remove fuel subsidy, we're not saying you shouldn't do it. Do it at the right time.
A person of interest is being questioned in connection with a string of arson fires in Hollywood. They were detained just hours after Los Angeles police released video of a man who witnesses place at several locations where fires started. A total of 55 fires have broken out since Thursday, including 45 in the Los Angeles area, 9 in West Hollywood, and 1 in Burbank. Police in New York are investigating a series of firebomb attacks in Queens, which hit places of worship on New Year's Day. The attacks with Molotov cocktails took place within 2 hours of each other. A convenience store and a private home were the first to be hit. An Islamic center and a Hindu mosque with up to 80 worshippers inside were also targeted. British police are flying to Pune in western India to provide support to the family of a murdered student killed whilst on holiday in the UK. Anuj Bidev was shot in the early hours of Boxing Day. A local man is due in court today accused of his murder. Nazir Afzal's from the Crown Prosecution Service.
There is sufficient evidence to provide a realistic prospect of conviction. Now that he has been charged, I must remind everyone that he is entitled to a fair trial and that any reporting must not prejudice that trial.
And Meryl Streep looks set for an unprecedented 17th Oscar nomination after earning glowing reviews for her performance as Britain's Margaret Thatcher in the movie The Iron Lady. Virtuoso, translucent and compelling were amongst the words used by US movie critics this week to describe Streep's turn as Britain's polarising, divisive and only female Prime Minister. Those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Christian. And now a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And here's your outlook for Europe. We ushered in 2012 with near-record temperatures across Western Europe, thanks to mild Atlantic winds, and the jet stream will send an Atlantic storm towards northwestern Europe tomorrow, Tuesday. It'll remain stormy across Europe for much of the week. Much nicer weather across Spain. Here's Tuesday's City Outlook. London and Amsterdam, 12 degrees, high winds and rain. In Prague, 7 Celsius and sunny. In Milan, 5 degrees, partly cloudy. And in Barcelona, it's 14 with sunshine. As far as air travel goes, Western European airports, some delays to flights because of high winds. That's right through Thursday. Over to North America, and the next few days, to sum up, cold and quiet. quiet, that is, for winter. The Midwest getting a dose of snow and cold Canadian air affects the eastern half of the US. Also feeling the chill will be South Florida. Meanwhile, in California, it's sunshine all round, perfect in the next 7 days or so. Good news there. So here's Tuesday's outlook. New York and Washington around 0 degrees, cold winds but sunny. Chicago -3, sun and snow flurries. In Dallas, 16 and sunny. In LA, 25 degrees and sunshine. Lovely weather there. Other world destinations for the next couple of days. Japan, cold north winds here, below freezing across Hokkaido, day and night, snow in Sapporo. In Tokyo, around 10 Celsius with sunshine. In Thailand, Bangkok, 34 and sunny. Australia, Sydney, hot and steamy, around 30 Celsius. It'll cool off a little bit later in the week. That's your weather. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Tomas. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozhalovat, Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Dette Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det her Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Fighting between rival militias, distrust between regional leaders, an uncertain economic future. Libya faces many challenges in 2012, challenges which the National Transitional Council will do well to meet. To give us her take on whether they're up to the task and what else to look out for in Libya over the coming 12 months, I'm joined here in Studio One by Monocle contributor Portia Walker, who spent much of 2011 in Libya and maybe heading back to Libya for much of 2012, perhaps.
Well, I'll certainly be heading back there in the coming weeks to see what's going on. I think a lot of people are going to be interested to see that now the war's over. Which predictions are going to turn out to be right. There were all sorts of ideas about what the new Libya might look like, from an Iraq-style insurgency to a new model of democracy and economic transparency in the region. And I think we're going to see somewhere between the two. I was most recently in Libya in December, and the country's still absolutely awash with weapons. And
There was supposed to be a gun amnesty, wasn't there? At the end of the year, militias were supposed to hand in their guns. I'm assuming that didn't really happen in any great numbers.
Absolutely. The deadline given was the 20th of December. And at that point, everyone was meant to hand in their weapons. And I'm afraid a lot of them are still unaccounted for. And that's not just, and when I say weapons, there's sort of two parallel issues there. Libya at the moment is full of guns. All the various militias, just, normal people, have a Kalashnikov at home. But there's also some more serious missiles that have gone missing. They're called MANPADs, and they're surface-to-air missiles that can shoot down essentially passenger jets, which is pretty scary if they fall into the hands of Al-Qaeda.
Mm. And let's look at the NTC itself. Towards the end of the year, they appointed a new Prime Minister, Abdulrahim El-Kaib, who was relatively unknown within Libya itself, of course, even more so outside. And he appointed a new government, which was seen as more secular and perhaps less Islamist than perhaps some people in Libya would have wanted. How much control does that government have in Libya at the moment?
Well, at the moment, it's incredibly hard to say. And I think that's one of the biggest problems. And the reason it's so hard to say is because this body we're talking about, the National Transitional Council, who were an interim government set up during the revolution, are, I'm afraid, deeply lacking in transparency. During the revolution, they didn't make the names of their members clear. It was understandable because some people were part of these revolutionary committees. The new revolution, not Gaddafi's revolution, during fighting, and it may have been unsafe for them to have their names announced. However, that with all of the country now liberated, It's unclear to me why the names of the governing body should not be made public. It's often unclear exactly how many people are in the different councils. I've had many times different answers given to me by authorities and spokesmen for this group within Libya. So there's a lack of transparency, and that's actually caused there to be a number of protests. There was one a couple of months ago in Benghazi where people were calling for more transparency and also calling for more local representation. They don't want to be recommended by this body of essentially self-appointed officials, many of whom are quite closely allied to the former regime, who are based in Tripoli. People are saying, well, you know, we'd like a local council.
And aside from those sort of differences and growing differences between the leaders and those who are being led, I mean, there are also differences between the different regional groupings, you know, within the NTC, whether people are from Benghazi or Tripoli or Misrata. How is that affecting how the country is being governed?
Well, I think what we've seen happen in the last couple of months is people from particular towns that feel, for various reasons, generally that their fighters were particularly brave or particularly successful, they feel they have a greater stake and should be rewarded, that their battlefield prowess should be rewarded in political terms in the new Libya. A case that particularly exemplified this recently was when Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam, who is he was Gaddafi's most high-profile son and very close to his father, and a lot of people saw him as one of the driving forces behind the civil war. He was captured on, I think it was the 18th of November in the south of the country by a group of fighters from Zintan, which is it's a smallish town. I think the population's about 30,000. It's 2 hours' drive south of Tripoli. And it's quite a poor place, you know, not particularly influential in the past. But having captured this, you know,
They have a prize. They have something to barter with.
I think a lot of people were rather, eyebrows were raised when a few days later the head of the fighters in Zintan was made Libya's new defence minister.
Right, so definitely got something for having Saif al-Islam.
Well, that's how it appeared many people there, absolutely.
When we look at the economy, you know, over the opportunities there might be in the next 12 months, I mean, you know, Libya in theory isn't a poor country. You know, there's a, you know, an awful lot of oil. Parts of the country that were doing relatively well, even, you know, during the last few years of Gaddafi's reign. What do the coming months hold for the economy?
Well, I think we're seeing an early stage at the moment, which is reconstruction, conflict resolution, mediation. So getting these different groups we're talking about to not fight with each other. It's a lot of rebuilding. A number of towns were really seriously damaged by the fighting. And I think the next thing is getting oil production up and running again. And that's actually a more optimistic story than initially may have been assumed. Libya was producing 1.6 million barrels a day before the war. And then officials now are saying that they're back to almost half of that already. And by the end of next year, they'll have resumed the level of oil production that was taking place before the war started.
And is oil production likely to continue with the same foreign companies that signed contracts under Gaddafi, or is some of this still up in the air?
It's very much up in the air, and it's a really interesting issue, because are deals signed with the former regime legally valid? There's also a question. There's a point that was made to me by a number of oil officials, which is, how are countries going to be rewarded for their contribution? And countries like Qatar in particular, and I would say United Arab Emirates and France, are very much seen as supporters of the Libyan revolution. And whether that military and diplomatic and financial support provided during the war translates into oil contracts is something that has been suggested by officials. The legal situation for that is debatable.
Well, indeed. Although I guess if you are now running the country, you can always change the laws. Portia Walker, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Time for a song. This is Heart Skipped a Beat by The XX. That was the XX. Coming up later on Midori House, we'll be joined by our New York editor, Aisha Spears, to hear about New Year's resolutions in the US. Stay with us.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about the things that we live with, the stories behind them, and the industries around them. From the paperclips on your desk, to the furniture in your home, the shops on your doorstep, to the signs that direct you to them.
What Japan offers up in terms of graphic design and architecture, you just cannot miss it. You have to go.
Section D is about craft, design, fashion, architecture and graphics in all their guises.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24. Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. 2011 was one of the most tumultuous years that many of us have ever lived through. Revolutions and uprisings, financial catastrophes and natural disasters. The next 12 months, though, may be just as turbulent. Over Christmas, we gathered together some of the brightest thinkers and smartest commentators for a five-part series on the world in 2012 called Global Briefings. Each day this week on Midori House, we'll be giving you a flavour of the debate, and you can download the whole series on iTunes and monocle.com/24. From the first show on the Middle East, here's Tim Marshall, Barrier Alamuddin, and to start, Shashank Joshi.
I think there are going to be sort of two focal points for the region. The first one is going to be Egypt. I think if you look back the last 12 months, the biggest story hasn't really been Libya or Tunisia or Yemen or Bahrain. It's been Egypt. It's the most populous country. It's the one that could be a sort of litmus test in some ways for other parts of the region. And the big question is going to be how a Muslim Brotherhood-dominated parliament engages with what's called the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, or SCAF, the ruling military council. Will it cut a separate deal? Will it engage with them in a way that allows both sides to remain content with their positions? Or will it confront the army? And how will liberals in Egypt react? Will they side with the army against the Brotherhood, who they have some fear of, or will they side with the Brotherhood, pushing for a constitution to be drafted on the parliament's own terms without interference from the army? I think that's going to be the defining issue, and it'll come to a head with the election of a president in the middle of the year, if all goes according to plan. But of course, as we've seen, these transitional governments have their own momentum, and we don't know how the army will react. I think the second major issue is Syria. And the big question for Syria is, does it go in the direction of somewhere like Yemen, where big chunks of the army defect and you have a sort of standoff in which Bashar Assad continues to rule over Damascus but loses control over big parts of his soil, which is already occurring? Or does it head in a more troubling direction in that which we've seen in two neighbouring countries, Lebanon on the one side, Iraq on the other, in something much, much messier, bloodier and altogether more concerning for the region?
Barry Alamuddin, when you look forward to 2012, what are your hopes and fears for the region?
Well, my hopes, of course, is, I totally agree with what you said, but I would be watching also other stories. My hopes would be that Syria would not turn as bloody as it might very well. It could be full-blown civil war, and it could definitely affect Lebanon and Iraq. And not only that, it could affect the Gulf, it could affect the whole region. We're talking here about a strife between Alawis and Sunnis. The majority of the population in Syria is Sunnis. It's about 75%. Of course, in Lebanon, we have the divide between the Shia-Sunni. It's quite evident. In the Gulf, it's evident. In Iraq, it's extremely evident. I worry a lot about Iraq, actually. Iraq is something to watch. The country could dismantle into little pieces here and there, and it could be full-blown civil war. And I do also see the Kurds could be involved. Iran is another story to watch. And this also is included in the Sunni-Shia divide. Iran has been working very, very hard to ferment such a divide in the area. So my point is, All this put also in the context of a nuclear Iran, and what will the West do? Would it be in Obama's interest to indeed take part in waging these strikes on Iran? You know, people, when they talk about Iran and a war, they think that it's going to be something like Iraq. It's not going to be something like Iraq. And indeed, the big question of capabilities, of the military capabilities of Iran, what it can it do?
Tim Marshall, you've been covering this region, you know, for a number of years. You go there, you get your shoes dirty. What are the things that, you know, that you've seen over the past year that particularly worry you, sort of looking ahead to 2012?
Everything we've just heard, but in focusing in on them, Egypt, I think we saw the outline of the deal throughout the year. The Muslim Brotherhood and the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces came to an understanding, tacit. It's why the election was able to go ahead. We will see, I think, that deal play out. They are smart enough to let them govern, because if they don't, the Muslim Brotherhood will turn the real people out on the street, not the liberals that came out in Tahrir Square. The real Egypt will come out, and that would collapse the whole thing. So they're smart enough to let the Muslim Brotherhood govern, and they will keep control of maybe justice, foreign affairs maybe, certainly defence. And you can't look at their budget. And if that's the case, Egypt can muddle along with the very difficult problems it has economically. Syria will crack, I think, next year. I don't know how, but I think it'll crack. I don't think the Assad regime in its current form will be there this time next year. Iraq, I just hope they're smart enough to also do the deals required, that it doesn't fragment. Iran, well, for ever since 2004, every year we've been looking at, oh, this could be the year where it's bombed. And I'm afraid you have to say it again. It could be the year. And that obviously needs watching closely. And it's not peripheral. It's actually central to the geopolitics of what's going on across the Middle East. Qatar will continue to have an increasing influence diplomatically, economically, everywhere.
The Brotherhood and SCAF to sort of rule jointly. Do you feel that the liberals, those behind much of many of the protests in Tahrir Square, have played their hand quite poorly since the, if we can call it, the revolution happened?
Well, it would be nice to imagine they've played their hand at all. They've spent most of the last 6 months. Of course, I salute their courage and I prefer their ideals and their values to those of the Brotherhood, but they've spent the last 6 months whining about matters of high politics, constitution-making, the fundamentals of the state. All well and good, but really it's not what most Egyptians care about. And when push came to shove, they didn't campaign. They didn't organise. They didn't engage in the bread and butter of democracy. Democracy is not about deciding, will you have a federal system or a unitary system? Will you have a Supreme Council whose budget is shielded? All of those are prerequisites for a good liberal democracy. But that's not really what Egypt's about at this point. And what they needed to do was simply organise in functional party systems with programmatic ideologies saying we will get food prices down, we will curb local police corruption. Did they do that? No. And therefore they ceded the ground to the Brotherhood.
Yeah, they believed their own propaganda. And mm-hmm. they actually thought they represented Egypt, which is quite stunning about how little some of the intellectuals of Cairo, how little they understood their own country.
It's sad that people are not realizing the rise of Islam that's been going steadily. I think the moderates have just chosen not to see it, have chosen not to deal with it. And it's been growing in the background all the time. And these people, this is what's worrying about people like the Muslim Brotherhood, because what you see is not what you get.
That was Tim Marshall, Barry Alamuddin and Shashank Joshi. And you can hear more of that and a whole series of global briefings on our website at monocle.com/24. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 talk, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 is
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After I met on Monocle 24.
The hat at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to the first Midori House of 2012, and in the next half hour, there'll be a bit of a New Year's theme. We'll be hearing from Aisha Spears in New York about how New Yorkers greet the New Year, and we'll be also taking a dip with some cold water swimmers. But first, here's the news with Christian Yeo.
Thank you. A person of interest is being questioned in connection with a string of arson fires in Hollywood. They were detained just hours after Los Angeles police released video footage of a man who witnesses place at several locations where the fires started. A total of 55 fires have broken out since Thursday, including 45 in the Los Angeles area, 9 in West Hollywood, and 1 in Burbank. Iran's navy has successfully fired another long-range missile. The launch of the weapon, capable of carrying a nuclear warhead, comes towards the end of a 10-day military exercise in the Gulf. Yesterday, America imposed fresh sanctions on financial institutions dealing with Tehran. Motorists and unions in Nigeria have expressed outrage after the price of fuel more than doubled when government fuel subsidies came to an end. Many fuel stations in Abuja and Lagos have shut whilst they figure out how to adjust their prices. Those which are open, though, are seeing queues of up to an hour. A senior Greek finance ministry official has been charged with failing to collect fines imposed on firms for smuggling. Yanis Kapaleris, who worked in the financial crimes unit, denies wrongdoing. The Greek finance minister has now demanded his resignation. Danish brewer Carlsberg says it expects its key Russian beer market to begin recovering in 2012, but fears the decline in Western European markets could worsen over the next 3 years. The world's fourth largest brewer says the Russian market, which accounts for a third of all group sales, will improve after suffering big tax hikes on beer, high inflation levels and regulatory pressures as well. And the US film critics have showered Meryl Streep with praise for her role as British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, leading to speculation the actress is set for her 17th Oscar nomination. Streep's performance in The Iron Lady has been described as virtuoso, compelling and translucent. Those are the stories at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Christian. Now it's time to head to New York. And we're joined on the line by Monocle's New York editor, Aisha Spears. Aisha, hello.
Hello. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too. Now we all know that Times Square is the place to be when the clock counts down to a new year. But what about what happens afterwards? New Year's resolutions. What do you think New York's New Year's resolutions should be?
I'm on a bit of a transport kick at the moment because having had to come back from JFK back into the city a couple of times in the last month, it's not pleasant for some reason. Although, you know, New York's one of the most frequently traveled to international cities. There's no simple way of getting from JFK into the city. There's no, you know, Heathrow Express equivalent. It's awful. It's a complete joke.
You've basically got to get a cab, haven't you?
You've got to get a cab. It's going to take you ages. You've got a cab driver who's going to probably like decide which is the quickest route, neither of which was going to be a quick route. You're stuck in traffic no matter what. You can brave the subway, but obviously the subway doesn't have escalators or elevators in it. So if you've got luggage, that's not an option. There are some dodgy coaches you can take, which still you're going to get stuck in traffic. It's really appalling.
So you think that there needs to be some sort of high-speed rail link between JFK and Manhattan that whizzes you there in 15 minutes?
Indeed. I mean, high-speed rail, I feel like I've said those three words so many times on Monocle 24.
You have quite a lot, actually.
I'm big into high-speed rail, but I mean, there are a few initiatives that I think the city are putting into play for next, well, for now, this year, 2012, in terms of transport. We're getting our bike-sharing scheme, is another thing I've been talking about a lot, and then they've also changed the taxis. So now you can also hail livery cabs, so like mini cabs. I don't know how you know if you can hail the right ones or not. We'll see how that works out, but that started yesterday. So I guess they're trying, but I really think it's ridiculous that you can't get from the airport to Manhattan in an easy way.
Indeed. And aside from your transport-related New Year's resolutions, what else has been happening in New York that we should all be thinking about or knowing about?
Well, I mean, as you said, you know, New York heralds the new year in Times Square, and I was, you know, at home watching it, thankfully not in it, and it's kind of a weird one.
Is it one of those things that's actually, you know, it's more something for outsiders to get excited about than New Yorkers themselves?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's like New York this weekend was packed full of people who don't live in New York. And I think that if you live in New York, you kind of stay in or go something slightly more civilized. And it's still there. I mean, yesterday, the streets were full of tourists. And today is the Rose Bowl, which is a big kind of football game that normally happens on New Year's Day, unless New Year's Day falls on a Sunday. So lots of people are off today in the States, too, watching that. But no, with Times Square is a big celebration full of probably non-New Yorkers. And it was Dick Clark's 40th one, and he's had a stroke a few years ago, and it's kind of a bit hard to watch someone who's gone through that hosting kind of something as celebratory as New Year's Eve. So that was a bit weird.
But he's a bit of an institution, isn't he, Dick Clark? That New Year's is his moment.
He is. I think he's only missed one, which was, I think, 2004, 2005, when he actually had the stroke. So no, he is an institution, but you do wonder why, you know, you feel like you're kind of watching someone who doesn't really necessarily want to be there. So no, I mean, I don't know. It's been amazing weather, so I think that's been quite good for New Year's Eve. It's probably been a lot of tourist time over here.
Oh, so quite mild.
Really mild. And I'm basically waiting for it to get snowy and horrible and cold, which will happen pretty soon. But we've had a really mild weekend, which has been lucky, and I think it's really helped to kind of... I'm sure it's brought a lot of money, actually, into the city.
Indeed.
So that's a good thing.
And other things to look forward to in 2012 for New York. I mean, what are the sort of the main things that are going to be, you know, they're going to be happening or are going to be changing within the city?
Well, I mean, separate to looking what's going to be going on nationally, obviously we're looking at the election, but, you know, Bloomberg's looking to, you know, he's kind of going towards the end of his term as mayor, and people are starting to talk about who may or may not kind of fill his shoes. I personally hope that he changes the rules and stays, because I think he's great.
Really?
Yeah.
He's already changed the rules once to stay, in a rather dodgy way.
Take a leaf out of Putin's book. Just stick around. Make a new position for yourself.
Make himself chief mayor and getting someone else to be the sort of Potemkin mayor.
Yeah, like executive mayor. Like have his own like little parliament down in City Hall. No, I think he's great. I mean, so he's done a lot. We've got more things that he's put into play, which are the, you know, green space. So the East River Park is getting bigger. You're basically going to be able to go from almost the top of the island of Manhattan all the way to the bottom on the east side on kind of green space, which is nice. They're kind of cracking down on crime. He said at his end of year review that crime's actually gone down, although some people are saying it's gone up. Again, he's changed the rules as to how to designate certain types of crime, which makes it look like crime's gone down. But
right.
They've got some corruption to fight in the NYPD as usual. But I think it's more a case of just kind of keeping Manhattan going without it really kind of collapsing on itself, which I think it always has the possibility to do because it's such an intense city.
Well, indeed, indeed. Okay, well, Aisha, we'll be speaking to you obviously an awful lot throughout the year, many, many times. But for now, thank you for giving us a New Year's taste of New York. That was Monocle's New York editor, Aisha Spears. You're listening to Midori House.
Every week, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24 and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and, of course, on iTunes.
So The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly business briefing. We are shining a spotlight on the people around the world who are driving innovation within their industry.
I didn't set out to become a perfumer, so it's almost an accident, which doesn't sound very business-like, but it is.
So it's not about bulls and bears, it's about small businesses, it's about the businesses you've always dreamed to set up. It's about the entrepreneurs who are daring to go out there and do it.
That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
You're with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, as the rest of Switzerland slowly stirs itself from its festive slumber and starts work after the New Year break, a factory 30 kilometres east of Zurich won't be turning the lights and heating back on because it never switched them off. The factory belongs to the Sauber motor racing team, and with only a few weeks left until testing starts in preparation for the new Formula One season, their workers only stop for a few hours on Christmas Day before being called straight back to their machines. But who are Sauber? And why base a motor racing team in Switzerland at all, considering the Swiss government banned motor racing more than 50 years ago? Ted Kravitz reports.
On a small industrial estate in the western corner of the small town of Hinwil, in the Swiss canton of Zurich, there's a factory where the work never stops. Outside the design office, a compressor fills an air bottle for use in a pit stop, while inside, the brains behind the operation, the engineers, sit and design fast race cars. Time is pressing on in the factory. An immovable deadline looms. The task, to manufacture, assemble and test three Formula One racing cars in time for the start of the season in Melbourne on March the 18th. But this kind of pressure is nothing new for Sauber Motorsport. You might have heard of Ferrari or even McLaren, but who are Sauber? Their CEO is Monisha Kaltenborn.
Well, we are a Swiss racing team, being in motorsport for more than 40 years. We are, I think, a medium-sized, down-to-earth team, very committed to what we do. Our only business is racing. And we, I think, do represent the very Swiss values of being down-to-earth, rather discreet, very focused. We're the fourth oldest team, so a team with tradition as well. That's what we are.
Sauber is unique. It's the only Swiss team competing in international motorsport. Given that motor racing has been banned in Switzerland since the Le Mans crash of 1955 that killed 83 spectators, it's surprising that there are any teams there at all. For most entrepreneurs, that might have been a hint that Switzerland wasn't exactly the place to start a Grand Prix outfit, but not for Peter Sauber, principal of his eponymous team.
Rundstreckenrennen, die sind verboten, ja.
Yes, circuit racing is forbidden, admits Sauber, but there's ski racing and slalom racing in Switzerland, and there is a Swiss Autosport Championship, so it's possible to go and participate at racetracks in other countries and go ski racing in Switzerland.
In der Schweiz.
Is motorsport still banned in Switzerland?
It is still banned in Switzerland, and there's a lot of discussion going on if one should revise that or even make a track and things like that. That's all still ongoing in Switzerland. It is a certain irony, but I think it also shows, again, a very typical Swiss way that if you are convinced of doing something, which our team owner and the team is, then we just go our way ahead, which is, I think, a very Swiss attitude.
But having the exhibition of your business activity banned in the country in which you're based is actually the least of the team's challenges. Sauber represents the best of Swiss engineering, but the centre of Formula One is actually in England, in areas such as Surrey, Norfolk, Milton Keynes and Oxford. So how difficult is it to base a team in Switzerland?
It is not easy in Switzerland to set up any motor racing activities. You simply lack the surrounding, the infrastructure for these things. If you compare it to England, you have so many suppliers in a certain region, so it's very easy access to services, people you need. And you don't really have that in Switzerland, so we had to build up everything on our own. And in a way, many companies around our company have come up because of our activity. So it's not easy to set all these things up and to then, of course, get the people across, because most of the people working in this business are English-speaking, and it's not easy to convince them to leave that part of the world and to come to a non-English-speaking country. So there are many obstacles to it, and you often don't get the support you would need from your surrounding.
But that's never discouraged Sauber. They raise their own sponsorship and only spend what they bring in. Their livery reflects the best in Swiss design. Clean, crisp lines. Their colours white, grey and red. The latter, in honour of engine suppliers Ferrari, interrupted only by sponsor logos and black Pirelli tyres.
Very simple, sober, not flashy, and we like the colour white.
They certainly do. Take a walk down the pit lane and you'll start at the bright colours of Red Bull with their loud music and carefree attitude. Ferrari is all red, a Segafredo espresso machine sits in the corner. But when you get to Sauber, all you see is white walls, white floors and a clinically clean bank of white toolboxes. Sauber's sponsor list, meanwhile, gives a pointer to their drivers. Telmex, run by Carlos Slim, possibly the richest man in the world, and another of Mexico's most famous brands, Jose Cuervo Tequila. Unsurprisingly, their first driver is Mexican, Sergio Perez, born in Guadalajara, He's the first Mexican in Formula One for 20 years and proud of it.
It means a lot. I'm very proud to be Mexican. Normally, all the Mexicans, we are very close. We support each other. Our Mexicans love the motorsport. They love Formula One, and to have a Mexican driver is just great. I'm getting a lot of support from the fans, which is very, very nice. It's something that motivates you a lot to have their support, to know that you are not alone in the other part of the world.
Perez comes from a wealthy family in Mexico. His brothers are also racing drivers, but that has not made him complacent.
They told me that if I want to go back to my home, where thanks God I have everything there, but I wanted to fight for my dream. And I told them that I will not go back till I do something very big in Formula One.
In the meantime, Perez works hard for his backers. In territories where alcohol sponsorship is forbidden, Jose Cuervo is replaced by the tequila company's other product, Cholula Hot Sauce. Sauber are renowned for their tequila parties in the Grand Prix paddock, but like all racing drivers, Sergio Perez doesn't drink unless it's his personal sponsor.
No, I'm not really much into alcohol. I don't like too much. If there is a good moment to do it, for sure. If I'm with good friends, with family, for sure I take the chance and spend some drinks with them. But normally, no, I don't. I just don't like to be eating with the wine or with tequila, but tequila I like sometimes.
Nicely remembered, Sergio. Sauber's second driver is from a country with a rich motorsport history, thanks to the likes of Honda, Toyota and Bridgestone. Japan's Kamui Kobayashi, one of the more modest drivers around.
I don't really think I'm Formula One driver. I'm one of the person in the team. And this is my part of job, which I had to drive. And I have to be fast. And I think everybody working very hard. And I have to work as well. But I think if this is Formula One driver, I mean, this is part of the teamwork. So I'm not thinking Formula One driver is something special. I think when you get my home, you don't feel I'm the racing driver because it's empty.
Kobayashi is distinctive amongst his fellow drivers on the grid. He wears his hair in a typical Japanese teenager way, tinted light brown and a swept-over fringe, while in the car, he's recognisable by the red and white colours of Japan on his crash helmet.
Well, I think, first of all, Japanese flag has red and white, and that's why, I mean, main colour. When I mean Japanese driver, it's only me. So, I mean, I have to show something more Japanese flag, which... it's something special, instead of another country flag color. It's really golden, in fact. No joke. It's not paint. You know, there's this very special, you know, gold trim, you know. Yeah, I like gold. So that's why there's a lot of gold.
That real gold leaf on his crash helmet, typical of Kobayashi's colorful style. But it's not just the Japanese and Mexican drivers that give Sauber an international flavor. Technical director James Key is British, chief engineer Giampaolo Dallara Italian, and there are no prizes for guessing where head of aerodynamics Seamus Malarkey is from. Manisha Kaltenborn believes Switzerland can attract top talent.
We have to, because there's no other way we could actually be. We could not just work, you know, with Swiss people. Why should we? Because we are in a global sport. We have teams from all over the world. And which is nice with us is that we can provide them the atmosphere they like also to work with, and then they stay with us. So I think being Swiss is a strength of ours, but that also means, which you see generally with Swiss companies, that how international they are. And often they're not even perceived as specifically a Swiss brand or a Swiss company because they become so international.
Sauber might be all about wind tunnels and cutting-edge engineering and technology, but it retains a homely feel. Since the early days, the cars have all carried the designation C for Christiane, Peter Sauber's wife of 40 years. This year's Sauber is the C31. So if you happen to catch a lap or two of the upcoming races in Melbourne, Kuala Lumpur or Shanghai, keep an eye out for the plucky Sauber team and their white cars. And spare a thought for the people of Hinwil, who worked through Christmas to build Switzerland's fastest export.
And that was Ted Kravitz reporting for Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House.
LDNTYO. NYCMT4.
Every new year, people like to shed the baggage of the months gone by. Most of us have a party to let off steam. But for some, that's not quite the baptism they need. And instead, they choose to plunge themselves into freezing waters. Why? I don't know. But I think we're about to find out. The New Year dip is a global phenomenon. And Monocle's Sophie Grove has been talking to a few of the people who prefer to plunge into those icy depths.
Sarah Hall, novelist. Why are you doing this jump?
I have no idea, but I'm doing it. It's strength in numbers. If everyone goes in together, then it's just sort of this fabulous freezing experience and you come out invigorated and you just feel like you're still alive.
How cold is it in there?
Well, apparently it's 6 degrees. It says so on the board, the chalkboard, as you come through the door of the club. But actually, I don't know. I mean, it never feels like 6 degrees when you're in. It feels like you're in the Antarctic.
Good luck. Anne Garvey, how brave are you feeling?
Not terribly at the moment, but it's a question of just getting in there and going forward, swimming and putting all thoughts of perishing on the spot aside.
We have a running jump here. How do you feel?
How do I feel? pain mixed with... cold.
Where's the euphoria, James?
James is climbing out. Pete, oh, one word.
That's so cold.
Very well done.
I think that sums it up pretty cold.
Any euphoria?
It's already coming, it's already coming.
I think there's a snifter of bourbon on site, on hand. And now you're gathered round a crackling bonfire. Is this the antidote to all that?
Marvellous warmth seeping in, and a nice tot of rum and a cup of tea, and everything is absolutely fine with the world.
And how many years have you been doing this for?
I think we've been doing it for about 6 or 7 years, and it's a family tradition, and we've done it every year since then, and none of us will miss it.
Sarah, or have you recovered?
I have. I'm standing by the bonfire. I'm standing as close to the bonfire as I can without actually smouldering myself. And I think I'm just about normal temperature.
I heard quite a lot of shrieking there as you submerged.
And you never know whether the best thing to do is just plunge straight in and then it's all over in a big explosion, or inch down the ladder. And I went for the inch down the ladder technique, which I might not do next year because the cold is just, it climbs up you in a slow and ruinous way.
And Anne, you've been doing this for many years. Can you just describe the scene in Cambridge here today?
Well, we're on the banks of the beautiful Granta River with indeed a few little canoeists going past, but it's a very sylvan, Edwardian, mysterious almost, with a little gate. And in we come with our golden key, and this is our little club. It's actually something of an open secret, but it really is a gorgeous place.
Well, you're all very brave, and thank you so much for hosting Monocle today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. But we thought for a special Monocle treat, we might have a round of singing, which will be led by novelist Sarah Hall.
What should we have?
Cruising Down the River, I think.
For Monocle.
Monocle.
Should all acquaintance be forgot, and never brought to mind? Should all acquaintance be forgot, for the sake of old lang syne? For old lang syne, my dear, for old lang syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet, for the sake of...
Oh, my word. Sophie Grove leading a rendition there. And I must say, I'm slightly disappointed because Sophie claimed when she came into the office today that she'd gone for a dip herself. But there seems to be no evidence in that report there that she dived in. Anyway, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And that is it for the very first Midori House of 2012. Thank you very much for joining us. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump, researched by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Monocle Daily will be on at 2200 GMT to kick off the day in Asia. We're back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours, London time. Headlines are next, right here on Monocle 24. But first, a song. This is Alley Cats by Hot Chip. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.
Two people are alley cats. We have an unhappy cat. He is restless, needs attention, loses patience, seeks affection.